Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hi, welcome to The Art of Memoir, A Story That Must Be Heard. My name is Marie Mutsky-Mockett. I am your moderator. Am I talking too close to the mic? And with me today are three... Yeah, I don't know what happened. Okay, there. Three wonderful writers, Francisco Cantu. Actually, I didn't check how to pronounce everything ahead of time, so forgive me. Julie Lithgow-Ames and Elizabeth Rosner. And we are here to talk to you about... I wrote a book, too. But we are here to talk to you about Stories That Must Be Heard. There's some wonderful thematic overlaps between all of the novels, or the memoirs, which are represented today. I do have to ask, please, if you can silence your cell phones or pagers, if you still own a pager. I haven't seen one in a long time, but if you could just put it on silent or vibrate. And I do want to also let you know you're going to be hearing some wonderful work today, and I know you'll want to purchase these books, and they will be available for purchase in the gallery / lobby, it says, after the session is over. Okay? Yes, do you have a question? Or
no,
you're all good?
Smiling.
Okay.
I'm just excited.
I'm excited, too. This is a conversation which is between the four of us, which has kind of already started, and we're really excited to share with all of you. Thank you so much for coming. What I'm going to do is ask each of the writers here to read a little section. We'll take turns reading a little section, discuss the little section of the book, and facilitate a conversation between the three of us, which will hopefully grow richer and more dense over time, and then hopefully we'll have some time left over for questions. I'm going to start with you, Francisco. I marked this little section, and I don't know if you want to set the context, but it's this piece here. I'm wondering if you would be willing to read that out loud to us, and then there'll be another little piece after that, and then I'll ask you a question. We'll just get started.
So I was reading this section yesterday because the Spanish translation of this book just came out, and I have to start doing interviews in Spanish, and Spanish is my second language. And so I was talking to some native Spanish-speaking friends who are also authors, and I was like, how do I prepare to do this Spanish? I haven't really talked about my book that much in Spanish. And they're like, well, you should read the Spanish translation of your book. And I was like, we're probably all so sick of our own books. So I was reading the Spanish translation of the book, and it's funny that you picked this passage because I was reading it last night, and I was sort of just like cringing at it in Spanish.
Do you want to do it in Spanish now?
No, I'm not going to read it in Spanish.
But we're going to love it.
But it's this very, just to give context, it's this conversation between my mother and I. I'm like a 23-year-old. I've just made the kind of naive and reckless decision to join the Border Patrol, and I'm sort of like arguing with my mother. And the reason I was like cringing so much about it is because I'm trying to justify to my mother like why it's okay for me to be joining the Border Patrol. And part of what makes writing memoir maybe hard is that you have to, I think, like inhabit the person that you were, and depending on how you're choosing to write. You can't clean it up and dress it up and editorialize like all the reasons that what you were saying and thinking at the time were wrong. So just hold that in the back of your mind as I read this. My mother shook her head. You make it sound like you'll be communing with nature and having heartfelt conversations all day. The Border Patrol isn't the Park Service. My mother was a Park Service Ranger. It's a paramilitary police force. I glared at her. You don't have to tell me that, I said. I'm the one getting my ass kicked at the academy. Listen, I know you don't want your only son turning into a heartless cop. I know you're afraid the job will turn me into someone brutal and callous. The people who look at you funny when you tell them I'm in the Border Patrol probably imagine an agency full of white racists out to deport and kill Mexicans. But that's not me, and those aren't the kind of people I'm seeing at the academy. Nearly half my classmates are Latino. Some of them grew up speaking Spanish. Some grew up right on the border. Some went to college, like me. Some went to war. Some owned businesses. Some work dead-end jobs. Some are fresh out of high school. Some are fathers and mothers with their own children. These people aren't joining the Border Patrol to oppress others. They're joining because it represents an opportunity for service, stability, financial security. My mother interrupted me. But you could work anywhere you want, she says. You graduated with honors. So what? I asked. I'm not necessarily choosing this as a lifelong career. Think of it as another part of my education. Imagine what I'll learn. Imagine the perspective I'll gain. Look, I know you're not an enforcement-minded person, but the reality of the border is one of enforcement. I might not agree with every aspect of U.S. border policy, but there is power in understanding the realities it has created. Maybe after 3 or 4 years, I'll go back to school to study law. Maybe I'll work to shape new policies. If I become an immigration lawyer or a policymaker, imagine the unique knowledge I'll bring. Imagine how much better I'll be at the job because of my time in the Border Patrol. My mother sighed and looked up at the ceiling. There are ways to learn these things that don't put you at risk, she said. Ways that let you help people instead of pitting you against them. But that's just it, I offered. I can still help people. I speak both languages. I know both cultures. I've lived in Mexico and traveled all across the country. I've seen towns and villages that were nearly empty because of all the people who had gone north for work. Good people will always be crossing the border, and whether I'm in the Border Patrol or not, agents will be out there arresting them. At least if I'm the one apprehending them, I can offer them some small comfort by speaking with them in their own language, by talking to them with knowledge of their home. Fine, my mother said, but you must understand you are stepping into a system, an institution with little regard for people.
Wow. So then... I think I'll just ask you to follow that up with this little section here. So anyone who hasn't read Francisco's wonderful book can hear a snippet of what happens once he doesn't listen to his mother.
So this takes place after I've gone through the academy and I'm sort of new at the station. Near the end of my shift, and this is shorter, don't worry. Near the end of my shift, Mortensen called me into the processing room and asked me to translate for two girls who had been brought in, 9 and 10-year-old sisters who were picked up with two women at the checkpoint. He told me to ask them basic questions. Where is your mother? In California. Who are the women who brought you here? Friends. Where are you from? Sinaloa. The girls peppered me with nervous questions in return. When could they go home? Where was the woman who drove them? Could they call their mother? I tried to explain things to them, but they were too young, too bewildered, too distraught at being surrounded by men in uniform. One of the agents brought the girls a bag of Skittles, but even then they couldn't smile. They couldn't say thank you. They just stood there, looking at the candy with horror. After the agents placed the girls in a holding cell, I told Mortensen I had to leave. My shift's over, I said. He told me that they still needed to interview the women who were picked up with the girls and asked me to stay and translate. I can't help anymore, I told him. I've got to go home. As I drove away from the station, I tried not to think of the girls, and my hands began to shake at the wheel. I wanted to call my mother, but it was too late.
Thank you. Kind of felt in all three of these books, all the authors were grappling with this line. I mean, you call your book The Line Becomes a River, but all of us are involved in trying to transcend something, cross something, stitch something together, see something more clearly, and whatever that thing is, and we can talk about what it is, we inherit that from our parents. So you're grappling with the past. Your memoir is so fascinating because you're in some ways you're kind of the only voice that has come out of a situation which is happening now, right? Going on now as we speak. Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you to read a little bit from your book here, and there's a little bit more. distance, I guess we could say, from the subject matter. Maybe you could set a little context for our audience.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here. Thanks for lining the walls out there. Okay. Crank me up. Okay. I was just saying hi. And thank you. So this is actually from the introductory chapter to the book, where I'm trying to lay out what my hopes and intentions are for the book as a whole, which is really, even though this is a terribly overused word at the moment, my book is a hybrid. So although it's often referred to as a memoir, my idea for it is that it's more than a memoir, because it takes, as all of our books do, I think, takes my personal narrative into a broader context of what is it like to inherit the traumatic experiences of your parents, your grandparents, your ancestors, and how does that connect me with other cultures, genocides, atrocities across time and place? And then on top of that, what does research show us about how that's happening? How is science now measuring that? What are all the both metaphoric and literal resonances that we carry collectively from historical trauma that not only affect us personally, but affect us, you know, societally and ultimately globally? So this is some of the personal part, but I'm drawing at least one or two connections. Although for much of my early life, my identity as a daughter of Holocaust survivors tended to set me apart from what I imagined were other people's normal families, in my adulthood, I began to discover, at first to my amazement and then with waves of empathy, that members of the second generation of non-Jewish Germans were carrying a parallel set of complicated feelings. Given the chance to listen, I found that although their stories sounded anything but identical to my own, the tangled emotions they described suggested an unlikely yet compelling familiarity. Disproportionate burdens of grief, anxiety, rage, and so much more. Ghosts of experience that both did and did not seem to belong to us. Gradually, my awareness expanded to recognize a web of intersections among other groups too, descendants of Vietnamese refugees, Cambodians whose parents had survived the killing fields, Japanese descendants of atom bomb survivors, as well as families who had been interned in American camps during the war. I feel a deep resonance while reading about survivors of the Armenian genocide and the tales told by their descendants, eyewitness accounts of the mass murders in Rwanda, studies of the centuries of racial violence and abuse inflicted upon Native Americans and African Americans. Every day, reports of hate-driven devastation in some distant or nearby locale remind me that human evolution includes the repetition of atrocities on a scale that defies all reason. Kriegskinder, Nachgeborenen. These are words from my German counterparts, children of the war, the ones born after. Tätergeneration is the word that refers to the generation of perpetrators. I've learned this vocabulary rather late in my life. Ironically, perhaps, it's a German psychotherapist named Bert Hellinger who developed a method called Familienaufstellung, family constellation, reminiscent of a Viennese practice called psychodrama, and somewhat familiar to family sculpting, a therapeutic technique developed by American psychologist Virginia Satir. In Hellinger's format, a group of strangers reenact their traumatic memories by posing one another in emblematic postures and relying on intuitive physical and emotional cues to explore family dynamics and, ideally, to shift them. These terms come from a New Yorker article by Burkhard Bilger, in which the author describes some of the practices of exhuming secrets and breaking silences in present-day Germany. Germans now suffer post-traumatic stress at more than 3 times the rate of the Swiss across the border. It's an understatement to call entangled the relationship between memory and storytelling, trauma and healing. In the Western world, we generally believe that narratives can help us feel less alone in our grief or suffering, that finding a way to share the experience can diminish its power to damage and fester. But how soon and how late? Thank you.
Thank you. And I think I'll just go straight to Julie. I have also chosen these sections for you, if you don't mind reading them in your... Let me move that.
Read this one?
Yeah.
Thank you for being here. I hope I'm loud enough. When I agreed to come here from Palo Alto, they said, you know, at that festival, there are going to be people in the back of the room who yell at you for not being loud enough.
Welcome
so
to Berkeley.
So thank you, Berkeley. Oh, so Berkeley. Love you, Berkeley. Hi from Palo Alto. I came from Sylvie. I am the untallied, unpaid, unrepented damages of one of America's founding crimes. I come from people who endured the psychocultural genocide of slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow, who began to find a place here really only quite recently amid strides toward effecting a more perfect union of liberty and justice for all. I am Sylvie's great-great-great-great-granddaughter. She was a slave who worked on a plantation in the late 1700s in Charleston, South Carolina, the harbor town through which close to 1 in 2 African slaves entered America over the centuries. Sylvie bore 3 children by her master, Joshua Eden, by which I mean he raped her. There is no consent in slavery. Sylvie's daughter, Sylvia, was born in 1785, and Joshua freed Sylvia and their other children some years later. Sylvia gave birth to a son named Joshua in 1810. Joshua had a son named Joshua Jr., born in 1845. His daughter Evelyn was born in 1896. Evelyn bore my father George in 1918, 100 years ago tomorrow. And I was born to him in 1967. The original Americans are the natives whose land was invaded, then stolen by the Europeans. Those descended from the Europeans, the ones who came on ships to the New World, like to think they are the original Americans. But I'm from a third set, from those brought here on different ships over different waters. Those whose sweat and muscle were the engine of the American economy for over 200 years, whose blood and tears water America's ground. I come from them. I come from people who survived what America did to them. Ain't I a real American?
Wow. I just loved your book, and I'll just spoil it. It's your brother who found Sylvie for you. Is that
yes.
right? Yeah. Which was an incredible moment because you open toward the beginning with Sylvie, and then we learn later that you didn't know about her until your brother did some genealogical research. Do you mind reading this one other section, and then I'll move over to some questions? Okay. Thank you.
Oh, Jesus.
You wrote it.
I usually read this when the audience knows me better. You mean, meaning I've had more time. A day comes when I summon the guts to tell Mary Ellen, this is an executive coach I'm working with while I'm a dean at Stanford University. She's been brought in to help me work more effectively with my colleagues. A day... A day comes when I summon the guts to tell Mary Ellen one of my most painful secrets. That as a child, I hated being black and was afraid of black people. This gut-spilling, fear-sharing loosens up knots of shame in my psyche, loosens the muscles not just in my mind but in my soul. Speaking this awful truth out loud through tears kneads the pain out of me. The relief feels astonishingly good. I wake up the next day no longer feeling the vice grip that asked me to prove I was good enough despite being black. I look in the mirror and allow myself to see not what whites might see or what they might want to see or what they might want not to see, not conforming to what they admire, to see my actual self, to see the color of my face and body, paper bag brown in fall and spring, high yellow in winter, milk chocolate in summer, and accept that some in America see me as the other and being fine with that. To see my skin and hair and hear my, quote, white speech and decide that it is not up to some committee on blackness to anoint me as black. It took me 40 years to stop twisting and turning this way and that in response to how I feared and hoped people of both races would see me. I drive to work that day having shed the loathing of my black self and by extension of all black people from my eyes, which had prevented me from really seeing other black people. I look into the eyes of one, then another black person, and I feel my heart swell with feelings like compassion, admiration, love, even desire, as if discovering their existence, their magnificence for the first time. It might as well have been the first time. Like climbing out of a deep depression, I hadn't known I was this afflicted until I wasn't.
I read that passage and thought it was so powerful, so authentic, and so clear. And I thought, I had this weird feeling, why haven't I read this before? It's exquisitely expressed and written. I would like to start, now that we've had a little sample from all three books, I'd like to know when each of you, since this is our panel is about a story that must be heard, can you talk a little bit about when each of you felt like, wait, this is a story that I need to tell, and why you felt it was something that needed to be written, and what is it that needs to be shared? Because this isn't, you haven't just written books that are for you, right? You've written books for people to read and to share in. So how did you come to think, I need to tell this story, and I need to share this story? You can jump in.
I'll start. If you know any of my work before this book, I wrote three novels and a poetry collection before this, and all of those books, in one way or another, also touch on my ancestry, my being a daughter of survivors, and how that informed my view of the world. But I was also always kind of tiptoeing around inclusion of other suffering. So in my first novel, I have a brother and sister whose father was an Auschwitz survivor who never spoke about it, unlike my father. My father always says, I am not the father in that book. but there's also a third central character in that novel who is a refugee from an unnamed country in Central America in which her entire village was massacred. So I was already trying to link both immediate experience of suffering and inherited suffering across boundaries, let's say. But some part of me was also very acutely aware that often in the Jewish community, and I mean this in a most respectful way, there is a tendency to want to talk about the Holocaust in its own context only. And the phrase I've heard half jokingly is, don't touch my Holocaust. So the don't touch and the my are very strongly emphasized there. And so I knew I was already sort of testing that taboo edge in my novels because in my second novel, I talk about reconciliation between a German son of a Nazi and an Israeli granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor. And in my third novel, I incorporate Native American lineage in the town I grew up in and the colonial invasion of the Dutch. And so obviously I was already sort of questioning whether the Holocaust needed to be only talked about in this private kind of contained way. And yet when it got to be time to take a trip to Germany with my father, which I write about in the book, in 2015, for the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Buchenwald, where he had been a teenaged prisoner, I came back from that trip quite affected by it, as you can imagine. And I was telling my editor that they had this event that they called Survivor Cafe. And he said, get out a pad of paper right now. This is the title. You're going to write a book of nonfiction, and it's going to be called Survivor Cafe, and here's the table of contents. And, you know, and he was saying that because he knew that I'd already written some short essays and pieces where I was, you know, getting at what is the word survivor all about? Where does that word come from? You know, I went through breast cancer. People said, now you're a breast cancer survivor. And I just had all these responses to that word. So, sorry, this is such a long answer, but I did feel like it was finally time to stop sort of using fictional characters and settings. Not that I wasn't doing it with all sincerity and I hope verisimilitude, but I was also saying, now I really want to drop all the way into everything I've been thinking about pretty much all my life and everything I'm thinking about because of what's happening right now. All the evidence of unresolved historical trauma that survives, that surrounds us all, and that impacts us all. And I wanted to do that in a way that very insistently made those interconnections and that said, you know, what you heard me read, that my experience of empathic opening, I wanted to share. I wanted other people to experience that too. And to say that we can help each other this way. We can recognize each other this way. And that's the only way we have any chance of preventing its recurrence. I mean, it's happening right now as we speak. And genocide, atrocity, mass exile, obviously racism, bigotry of all kinds, violence, linguistic violence. So it felt as urgent as it has ever felt to do this now. Thanks.
So for me, I mean, this is my first book. I think I, for a while when I was younger, I imagined that I would write fiction like on the side because I was never shown growing up that writing was sort of like a viable career option. It was sort of like the desire to like become an actor. You're like, that's so unattainable. But you know, cause like my biological father is sort of a failed writer. And so, you know, it was never something, writing was always sort of this, afterthought, like it was for me. But it wasn't anything. I mean, the question was sort of about, you know, when do you realize that this is something that could be shared? In my case, you know, I joined the Border Patrol looking for answers, right? I had all these questions coming out of, I had studied immigration and border issues. I had all these questions coming out of college. I was from the Southwest, but I went to school on the East Coast. And so I looked at, you know, I felt that a lot of my learning was very separate, felt very far away from the realities that I had seen and known growing up on the border or near the border. And so, you know, that was what brought me to join. And then, you know, I realized it wasn't until I kept a journal, I guess, was the only real writing that I did during that time, during the years, the 3.5 years that I was doing that work. And in that journal were mostly just kind of encounters that I had with people, like descriptions of like the one that I read about those two girls. And I think I wrote those journal entries because I knew even then, very quickly after I stepped into that job, that if I didn't write it down, I would forget it.
You make it clear in your book that this is, over time, you come to realize, oh, the more time goes by, oh, this has a cost. This has had a cost for me. Where I come from has a cost for me. Having had this experience has a cost. It's having a cost on them, and it just keeps accumulating, right?
Yeah, I think that word accumulation is really central to sort of my experience and what led me to write about it. The other thing in that journal were dreams, right? I was having all these really violent dreams, recurring dreams. And so I think after I finally left the job, those dreams, sort of like making sense of those dreams. I think what I realized maybe 6 months to a year after I left that work is that I had sort of become, without realizing it, like obsessed with violence. And I had been, and I was inhabiting violence in my subconscious, you know, without ever sort of grappling with it in my waking life. And so I initially, I think, you know, the first version of writing that ever really became part of this book, aside from those journal entries, was this writing in which I was attempting to sort of like examine these dreams, like what, you know, what are these symbols and scenes of violence in the dreams? Like, what does that mean? I was reading a lot of psychoanalyst writing and you know, Jung and all this stuff. And I think I wanted to examine for myself. So this book definitely started as writing for myself, as I think a lot of books do, especially a lot of memoir begins that way. I was trying to examine, I think, how I had come to live in this world of violence.
And I think the other thing, actually, all the books make clear is that you never sort of escape this central question. You put the word line in the title of your book, and you never really can escape this border, right? I'll put the same question to you, Julie, and I'll just add, one of the things I loved about your book is how you take us through your life, essentially, and how you reflect on race over time as you grow up and as you are a mother and as you have children. And I would say, I grew up in California, and I lived and went to New York and then came back. And I think I thought of, you know, I sort of had this split reality, and I thought of race as this thing that you learn about and then you grow up and become an adult. But it, of course, it never leaves you. And you bring this in your book, how this continues to play through your life. But anyway, I'll just put the question to you.
To that, I would say I hope that the trauma of it, if that is what we have learned, leaves us, and we are left with the joy of a cultural connection to our people. So my book, I was this dean at Stanford. I was very concerned about helicopter parenting, which I was seeing some evidence of on our campus, as were others on campuses across the nation, including nearby. And I decided I'm going to try to write a book. I had written an op-ed. I had been told all my life that my writing was not strong. And I wanted to go get an MFA to try to be able to be the person who could write this book on helicopter parenting. So I went to CCA to get an MFA and was workshopping chapters of what became How to Raise an Adult, my first book. Mm-hmm. But when I was not writing about helicopter parenting, which was really kind of in the margins of my MFA, it has a strong narrative, but it's, you know, the sort of straight-up nonfiction book. In my poetry classes, in my creative nonfiction classes, the topic that kept bubbling up and out of me was race. And so it was sort of inevitable, I think, that my second book, which was actually my thesis at CCA, became Real American, this book on race. Why did I feel the need to tell it? So it was coming up out of me with urgency. It was buried. These stories were buried, lurking, you know, growing, but lurking like tumors, you know, sort of begging for my attention. And so it was a summoning to my own consciousness. The daring to tell the truth of it to myself was first. The daring to put it on the page and share it, you know, in a classroom workshop setting or with trusted mentors was next. And then the daring to share with others, strangers, by making it into a book, was the third step. I had hope that, so this is a book about, I'm a black person with a lot of privilege. I am light-skinned, I'm highly educated, I'm female, I'm upper middle class. And so this is not a memoir of suffering, which is what we might think of as a more typical, traditional black narrative in America. I am the child post-Martin, post-Loving versus Virginia. My own existence was a little bit more allowed in the American narrative coming up in the 70s and 80s. But I think this boils down to being a memoir about how racism is agnostic to class and the degrees you have and who your daddy is. And I had hope that in sharing of some of the things I went through, which I was too ashamed to even acknowledge to myself for decades, that other black folk might feel seen and heard in their experience because of what I had decided to share, and beyond black folk, biracial folk, and people of color more broadly, and queer folk, and so on and so on, the many of us who are made to feel like the other in a country that claims to be welcoming of all. So I'd hoped it would be of use to other people. And I hoped that white folks and all of those folks who had not been experiencing the kinds of things I had might be stimulated to feel some compassion. And the greatest compliment this book has received, I think, came from a little white girl of 5 years of age in Baltimore, Maryland, whose parents rather unwittingly, I think, brought her to my reading, which is very, and I kept looking at them as I knew them, and I was like, are you sure? You know, and I wasn't saying like, are you, you know, should I change what I'm about to read next? But like, don't you want to walk out the door with your 5-year-old child? Because I'm about to do that. And they kept signaling like, no, 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 we're good. So anyway, on the drive home, the little girl piped up from her car seat. I know she was talking to my ears, but it felt like she was talking in my heart. Aww. And to me, that's a lovely child's wisdom of what compassion feels like, to feel something. And that it was my hope that my book might make people feel something.
So can these traumas leave us if we talk about them? Is that, I know you deal with some of this, Elizabeth.
It's pretty much on every page, that question. And, you know, because of this new conversation about something called epigenetics, which a lot of you probably have heard that word, have you? So epigenetics literally translates as something on top of the gene. The idea being that we are coming to recognize that trauma actually can modify the expression of some DNA. And one of the ways that shows up is in cortisol levels, for example. Cortisol being a stress hormone that helps your nervous system regulate incoming stress or continuing stress.
Can I just interject that we were, really briefly, we were talking about this last night at the party and how this research has been done on Holocaust survivors. But of course, in a lot of folk cultures, we talk about curses, family curses lasting 5 generations, but they show in epigenetics that the expression of that gene that gets switched on for more stress or however it's altered lasts 5 generations, at least in mice. So it makes one think there's something to those folks.
Yeah, I think what we're finding is that, you know, as is often the case, science catches up eventually with what we know anecdotally to be true or what we've already experienced in our own bodies or in our own familial legacies. And so the question then arises, does this mean you're doomed to carry this accumulated trauma? Does it mean that, you know, even if you don't yourself experience trauma, you walk around with PTSD for the rest of your life because of what you've been given, what's been transmitted to you? And so the answer I'm finding is that, you know, biology is not destiny and that there are things we can do to address it, but you can't not address it. Or let me put it another way, you shouldn't not address it. And that even the molecular biologists who are studying epigenetics and talking about its appearance in these genetic and hormonal levels are saying this can remodify. You can address it, and you know, behaviorally, therapeutically, and again thinking about what Marie just said about in cultures that we think of as, you know, sort of not medically advanced or whatever kind of lingo you want to use for that. You know, there are cultures that have employed all sorts of rituals and body-centered therapies and practices, spiritual approaches for sure, to address trauma and the residue of trauma in the body without using, you know, psychotherapy or intervention from, you know, the medical masters, but really trusting the culture itself to know that when you bring a veteran home from war, you don't just reintroduce him into domestic life, him or her, and expect, you know, everything to go fine after that. There, just as you turn someone into a warrior, you have to bring a warrior back into a more humane environment. And you do that actively and carefully and empathically again. So I think the images of trauma and the repetition of trauma that we all feel and recognize, I think it may never all the way go away. You know, when you talk about may our relationship to race and self and identity eventually be gone, I think maybe, you know,
not
what
be gone, the trauma of it be gone.
Yeah, but what I think, you know, my sense is that the naming of it, not just with words, but in as I say, in spiritual practices too, is a way of softening the edges of it, and that can dissolve very, very slowly, and it may take several more generations for it to transform too. And I say that in a hopeful way, you know, I don't say that in a despairing way.
Well, and you make this point in your book too, when we talked about the Armenian genocide, that this term is not permitted.
It's illegal.
So there's power
to say
around
Armenian
actually having
genocide.
The term.
Yeah. Sorry, so not to step on you, it's illegal to say the words Armenian genocide in Turkey. So, you know, words, they have this kind of totemic power, and to silence words is its own form of traumatization. So not only have you been victimized, you've now been doubly victimized by the silence that's imposed upon you. And I think that happens in race absolutely in this culture.
Well, and that's the power of shame too, right? And because it has the effect of silencing somebody who might have a story to tell.
Yeah, that if you've been told over and over again, I'm sure this speaks to you, Julie, that we're in a post-racial world now, and you're harboring this sense, wait, I haven't reconciled myself with myself, so I'm not supposed to talk about that because everybody
right.
else has passed it.
Or I experience these microaggressions
yeah,
that happen
yeah.
to me that may not happen to you, but that's my reality. Don't tell me they're not happening. That's
yeah.
like it's a form of gaslighting. Yeah. It looked like you wanted to say something, Francisco.
I was just interested hearing Elizabeth talk about, I think that one thing like living in the borderlands that I think about a lot is how you know, when someone goes to war and comes back from war, or when someone experiences an atrocity that is then recognized and talked about as an atrocity, I think like as a society we're able to recognize that something has gone wrong and talk about it and grapple with all of the residue that someone would, you know, the post-traumatic stress, the moral injury that comes from that. But one thing that I was very preoccupied with in writing this book is, you know, all the sort of atrocities that we do not recognize because they're happening in this slow, drawn-out way. And, you know, with regards to the borderlands, like especially on the Mexican side of the border and on the U.S. side of the border, you know, like war is being waged along the U.S.-Mexico border at sort of this, it's like low-scale warfare. And people, you know, migration is a very traumatic act, and to migrate to this country, a migrant's body is commodified and dehumanized, and trafficked and exposed to all these threats and fears that are sort of ongoing. Even once the migrant arrives to this country, you know, I know people in my community who are afraid to leave their home, who think that it's within the realm of possibility for a helicopter to land in their yard and take them and their children away at night. And that's the kind of fear that we imagine someone living with under military dictatorship in a faraway country. And I think that there's also, so I think part of what we're seeing right now is that we are sort of unable to grapple with that trauma or recognize or like see people and recognize that they're living in and inhabiting trauma because we haven't named it or recognized it yet. And so I think that's also an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't help but think of the new museum honoring the victims of lynching that has opened this week in Montgomery, Alabama, and to have awakened this morning to a story about backlash by those who think, really, are we really telling that story? You know, and that narrative that says we whine too much in the context of a country that has never atoned for its sins. So this is our moment. I think it is our decade. I think it may be our century when we dare to exhume the trauma of America's origin and right up to its present and talk it through and process the trauma so that we might collectively as a people heal. Knowing that along the way there will be people saying, get over it, that was a long time ago, that bears no relation to the present. We must keep going, regardless of what they say. At a personal level, for me, naming what I experienced began to loosen its grip on me. So that section I didn't want to read. No. What I mean is, right?
It's tough. So bad.
It's tough to just say to a room full of people who showed up, you know, whom I don't know. I mean, I recognize a few faces in the room, but like, as a child, I hated being black and was afraid of black people. Like, I want you to know how I got to be the person who could acknowledge that to myself. I was working with the coach around, why am I so angry? Why am I so passionate? You know, she was telling me, effectively, you're showing up as the angry black woman and people don't like it. Now, she didn't say it like that. I heard it like that. But I became interested in, why am I constantly so needing to prove myself? Well, I began to unpack that, and I realized it was the accumulative effect with some really punchy moments, like being the student body president of my all-white high school in Middleton, Wisconsin, where on my 17th birthday, when I'm the president of the freaking school, someone writes the N-word on my locker, and I never tell anybody because I'm so ashamed. Okay.
Or the father. I was going to ask you to read that, but we probably don't.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of my time here, but yes, there was just more and more of it, and not a surprise to anybody, right? So it turns out that my trying never to be called the N-word again, trying to perform the part of the black person who will not incur the wrath or loathing or disregard or discarding of white folks, was animating my performance through undergrad, law school. I'm a corporate lawyer, I've become university dean, and all of those years of my life are in the pit of my book, which is really the arc, the big curve, like the loathing pit that I emerge out of. Naming the truth of it to myself began to loosen its grip from me. You know, the generational stuff, the ways in which I am Sylvie's great-great-great-great-granddaughter, and the traumas my ancestors endured, the extent to which the epigenetic stuff is within me, and I believe it, and so on. I have no idea what it takes to ease that hurt, but I do know that the power of telling the truth of it to ourselves is incredibly healing. Mm-hmm. At least it has been so for me.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
There's a therapist named Darlene Lancer who writes a lot about codependency, and she said that really the key out of any shame or toxic shame, et cetera, is authenticity, which is a tall order if you look around you and you don't see yourself reflected back to you. I wanted to say, you know, one of the things they do in Japan that I wrestle with is we make things very beautiful. And beauty is incredibly transcendent. I do a talk on Japanese fairy tales. Unlike Western fairy tales, which end with a death or a wedding, a lot of Japanese folk tales, fairy tales, end with some beautiful image, right? The cloud is over the mountain. The moon is slightly obscured by the cloud. And then you feel this sort of sense of completion with the wabi-sabiness of it all. And I, you know, they're my people. I get into it. The other part of me thinks, can we please not make everything so pretty? You know? It's not, and it's tempting with a book. I can make this story beautiful. I can make it end beautifully. And so I struggle all the time with I need to find this authenticity. But I do also believe that transcendence is powerful. You know, I'm from California, the sunset at night is great. It definitely puts me in a better mood. So I'm wondering, in all of that, how do you handle with this book as a made thing, as planting some sort of beautiful transcendence on versus truth-telling? I mean, like Francisco, there's some really beautiful sections in the desert and the satellites and the stars and...
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that question. And it's something that I've sort of been grappling with in the aftermath of like the book coming out. And I think one thing about the U.S.-Mexico border as a landscape, as like a region, is that it is so often represented as a landscape of violence, right? It's a backdrop for violent stories, and quite often that is, you know, being done in the same breath that we are using that violence to other the people who are coming across our border, right? Like the people who are coming across the border are being represented as violent. The place is being represented as violent in order to like we're seeing that right now more than ever before, sending the National Guard to the border when, you know, crossings along the U.S.-Mexico border are at their lowest point in 40 years. So, you know, the border has never been more secure, but we are still representing this as a landscape of violence. So as a writer, you don't want to participate in that myth making, but at the same time, if you're preoccupied with violence and if you're preoccupied with the real ways that this is a violent landscape, you know, for example, although crossings are at their lowest level in 40 years, there are still hundreds of people dying every year in the desert. And we don't talk about and acknowledge those deaths, right? Pima County, where I live, I was talking with a journalist the other day, and she was talking about when those deaths started to happen in Pima County, where I think it's one of the largest counties in Arizona. It's where I think the most deaths have been recorded in like the most recent decades. They started, when those deaths started to occur in the early 2000s, they were printing the names of the people who died in the paper. They no longer do that. At a certain point, they stopped doing that. And so although crossings are dropping, the deaths are remaining the same or even increasing. And so how do you write about violence without perpetuating the image of a place as a violent place? While also being truthful and reckoning with that violence, and I think, you know, one way you do that is you talk about the right kind of violence, right? Like the violence that happens here is not a cartoonish Old West violence. It's a very sort of like matter of fact violence that is perpetuated by our rhetoric, that is perpetuated by policy. And I think that it's a violence that can be fixed. I think what's harmful is to think about a landscape as inherently violent, right? Like the desert is always talked about as inhospitable, and it's a violent place, but it's not. It's a perfect place. It's an environment. It's a biome that perfectly functions, has everything that it needs for the plants and animals that live there. But we have brought violence to it. So I think, like, how are we bringing violence to places? And to, you know, to identities, right? Like we are bringing violence, because that violence that happens on the border is disproportionately affecting people of color who are fleeing violence, who are being dehumanized, who are being, you know, made to endure hell. Like we're preoccupied with making the border so hellacious that people will not cross it, but people will always cross it, no matter what version of hell you put at the border. We have seen now for decades people will endure that and lose their lives.
I'm so struck by what you said about the erasure of those names, you know, that now the victims aren't even being granted the names. And I was thinking about the gorgeousness of hearing the Bagats in your piece, and that Joshua recurs, and the recurrence of Sylvie and Sylvia, and this idea that what Brian Stevenson has done in this incredible memorial that I can't wait to go to, and that I wrote about in this book a little bit too, is the naming of the victims of lynching one by one, as many as are so far known, 4,400 names so far, and the parallel that Ryan Stevenson makes with the naming of something called Stolpersteine throughout Europe. It was begun by a Berlin artist who started, it translates as stumbling stone, and he started replacing cobblestones with a gold-stamped stone with the name of someone who lived here, the last known residence of people who were murdered in the Holocaust, name by name, place by place. And the other thing that the museum has is the soil from these lynching sites, so that it physicalizes it. It connects the name with the body and the place. And that is, you know, thinking of your question, is that beautification? Well, it's an acknowledgement of the horror and the beauty side by side. I think the beauty of this person that once was, the horror of what was done to this person, and again, this principle of we cannot keep looking away from this. Yeah. You know, we've looked away so long, and for us to be looking at it now for the first time and being told, oh, enough of that, we've mm-hmm. looked, you know, just makes me crazy.
You know, this is a little off topic, but there was something, you've just said something that reminded me of something earlier you said, Elizabeth, about the great anxiety, the grief, anxiety, and rage the descendants mm-hmm. of the evildoers feel. Mm-hmm. And so we're speaking about a trauma experienced by people crossing the border, being a border crossing agent, mm-hmm. being a descendant of a Holocaust survivor, being an African American, a descendant of African slaves. But there is trauma, too, in the descendants of those who harmed us yeah. and would harm us. And one of the reasons they don't want us to tell our stories is it is so painful for them to accept the truth of that. And yet they, too, have to examine it and be able to notice it and experience their own feelings and work it out and work through. And I try to make a little bit of room for that in Real American. I have this encounter with a friend who... I narrate the encounter, which is, you know, what are you writing about in Real American? I tell her some of the stories. This is a white woman who starts to cry about how hard this is for her to hear. And I say in the book, as I said then to myself, I can't fucking believe this is happening. Here she's crying. This is like a thing you hear about and people write about, and now I'm experiencing it. Now I'm comforting her about how sad she is about the stories I'm telling about black people. And so I put that, and then a few pages later, maybe a chapter or two, every page is like a chapter in here, you know, some pages later I come back to her with compassion for that stone lodged in her gut, which is the weight of what white Americans have done to black people in this country. And I acknowledge that that stone is lodged in her and that it must be painful. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I will talk to her. If she comes to me with an open heart, I will come with mine. And in that sense, I'm suggesting that compassion, connection, love. I mean, I think for me, the pretty parts are the tremendous ways in which love shows up. Love between father and daughter. Love between mother and child. But love between friends and mentors. Love between mentor and mentee. Well, that shows up and becomes an omnipresent force of healing and beauty despite everything else.
Mm-hmm. We have 10 minutes left for questions, and we do have people who want to ask questions. Want to ask if they can come here and take the mic and ask you questions directly. Sorry.
I'll find a way to say it and answer it. I will.
Oh, sure. I'm going to direct my question to both Julie and Elizabeth. It's a two-part, so whichever calls to you. Can you speak about pain versus catharsis when you were choosing to write about the painful parts of your stories? And the second part of my question is, what's the legal risk of writing about others, especially when you're writing about someone who may have done some real harm and may come after you? What are your legal protections?
I'm not going to touch that legal part, but the pain catharsis—that's a really interesting and quite nuanced place you're getting at there. And I think that that's so deeply individual, you know, that writing and you know, I am always reluctant to talk about how hard writing is, because I feel like no. Putting roofs on tar buildings in the desert sun, that's hard. You know, my writing life is so easy compared to that, and a lot of other jobs. But the pain of writing, you don't always know where the pain shifts into catharsis for the self. And sometimes you can only know that after the fact. Where was my catharsis? I mean, this is going to, again, sound so sort of self-centered and maudlin, but there are times even now, I recorded this book for an audio version, and there were moments when, you know, my voice cracked, and I was feeling the emotion all over again of the writing, of the thinking, of the processing, of the... So it isn't gone yet. I mean, if you can say catharsis is the place beyond which the emotion doesn't need to go... I haven't gotten there yet, in a way. I mean, I think the pain and getting back to beauty. I mean, I think pain can be beautiful. And the image I wanted to mention, see, I told you I would say it, is the image of kintsugi, which Marie and I were talking about, and you've seen it, you may not know the word, but it's Japanese ceramics with gold filled in to the cracks. And I write about this in the book because it's such, for me, a resonant image about suffering and how you hold your pain. Not to erase it, not to throw the broken pieces away and try to resurrect a new unbroken self, but that you embrace the scars and you beautify the scars. And so to me, that's where catharsis isn't exactly... I mean, maybe that's my definition of my catharsis, is that I've allowed myself... To feel beautiful in the broken places. And that, I think, is such a universal possibility. I think each of us has to find our way there. Wait. Well, I don't know if you want to get at that.
Yeah, so I narrated my own audiobook. I, too, cried in various moments. I paused and said, do you want me to redo that? And the engineer said, nope, sounds like that's what this book wants. And I hope I never evolve to the point of not feeling my own pain. Okay, I don't want to be this sort of, I'm numb, I'm past that, I'm right. I just don't want to be traumatized by it anymore. So I can, with compassion, listen to my own story and feel it and not be re-wounded by it, though. Mm-hmm. So it's a very subtle thing. I mean, we're complex as humans, and I'm not a psychologist, so I don't understand half of this. But I will tell you that I am not, that there was a relief, I will call it relief or release. Maybe catharsis is what you mean by that. You know, to look the pain in the eye, dare to say what it was, gave me relief, you know, and allowed me to be able to talk about it without it being a wound still in me. Yeah.
All right, we have another question here.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had a reader in mind as you were writing your memoir.
All of us? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead, Francisco. You didn't get to the last question.
Let me think about that.
I had a reader in mind. I had black people in mind. I had people who might have grown up like me, black and biracial, in a white place. And I wanted them to feel less alone. What intrigues me is that white folks read this book and say, thank you so much for teaching us all this. Like, they think I wrote it for them. And I'm delighted. But I will say that white folks were sort of my third audience, like the rippling stones of like the immediate audience and the secondary audience. Compassionate white folks willing to entertain the ideas. They were way out there, but they think I wrote it for them. Mm. Which is, it's very meta.
Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't say a reader singular, but I can say that when I was really feeling the urgency of writing this book, it was partly... my father, who is 89, and the image of these survivors at the Survivor Cafe, you know, in wheelchairs and on, you know, using canes, and the idea that very soon, we don't know how soon, but soon enough, there will be no living firsthand witnesses to the war, the World War II. All of that experience, including the liberators of concentration camps, who often were traumatized phenomenally and silenced. But, you know, once upon a time, the last living slave passed away, and we lost that firsthand testimony, too. And the last living witness to World War I and on. So this, my audience in a way was the people who are noting that disappearance and want to know what is going to change at this threshold moment, and what's our now obligation as those still here.
Can I interject something about catharsis too? That comes to us from the Greeks, right? Catharsis. But it wasn't like you went to the plays once, had your catharsis, and then you were done for life, right? They kept doing the plays every year. You kept going through catharsis. They kept writing new plays so that you kept having catharsis. So they kept coming up with this way for people to experience catharsis throughout life, right?
I'll give maybe like a weird answer to your question. Sometimes I think about, like, in a way, hoping that, like, my book would, like, trick some readers. And I live in Arizona. I grew up in a very white town, like a cowboy town. And so I think about, like, I think about readers who, like, wouldn't be inclined to read, like, an immigrant narrative, but them seeing, like, some book by, like, a Border Patrol agent and being like, well, I'll read that. I think the book really asks the reader to, like, inhabit this story and to be horrified. Like I'm asking the reader to read these things that I participated in, like, more than observed, and to be horrified by them. And to, like, inhabit the feeling of, like, oh, this is not black and white, because the border is always represented as this black and white issue. When you hear about the border, it's usually because someone is hawking a solution, right? Like, build a wall. So I thought a lot about that. I thought a lot about, like, making people inhabit complexity and being uncomfortable and horrified by it.
So I love that word trick. I'm wondering how much of that sense of tricking, and it's not really, you're not really tricking them, isn't that part of the gift of being biracial and of inhabiting two worlds and knowing I can tell the story in this way? Is that part of it?
I mean, part of being biracial is being tricked.
Yeah.
I was listening to what Julie was saying about, because your experience when you were talking, the section that you read from, about how you sort of grew up hating being black or being afraid of black people, like, that was my mother's experience, you know, like, and it wasn't just society that made her feel that way. It was her own white mother. My mother's half Mexican, and she didn't grow up with her Mexican father. She only grew up with her white mother, and you know, my great grandmother would praise her whenever she did something good and connect that to whiteness. Like, she was like, "Oh, that's your German Irish work ethic. Like, great job." And then whenever she was bad and did something lazy or, you know, failed to turn something in, she's like, "Well, that's your lazy Mexican side coming out." And so I think, like, part of, you know, it's natural, right? We're being made to participate as we grow up in the othering of this, you know, biracial, multiracial identity in ourselves. And I think, you know, part of what our job is to, like, bring the othered part of our identity out from underneath this shadow of whiteness or this shadow of, like, nationalist American identity.
We could do one more question. I feel like there was a...
I'm a little nervous to ask this, but I've lived in Oakland for 36 years and done public health, done work in East Oakland, and I'll be in a situation where I'm the only white person there, and a kid is telling me a terrible thing, and I start crying. And my bosses are saying, "You're not being professional," and I want to say, "Why aren't you crying?" Yeah. But I just wonder, Julie, if we could come up with a word for not the white fragility where you feel guilty about being white or white privilege, but it's just your heart hurts because you just witnessed something that's horrible. And that's why you're crying. And I don't know what word that is, but that always slipping to the white fragility is very uncomfortable for me.
It's a beautiful question. Tell me your name. I know we met earlier. I can't remember your name.
Janae.
I think what we want is to know why we are crying. I think that young person you were meeting with in East Oakland in a public health context is nourished to know that you feel compassion for whatever their circumstance is. So it's how to have the tears and to blink through them and say with language, I'm so sorry you're going through this. This is terrible. Keep the feeling and the experience with them rather than, I am having such a hard time hearing you say this. This is so hard for me. I can't believe there's so much injustice in the world. And then you've moved way far away from this human who's suffering in front of you. You want to empower them with your compassion rather than deplete them further by letting it sort of start to fill up, you know, a deeper well of concern for you. I don't have a word for it, but that is the practice that I would encourage you to cultivate.
Yeah, beautiful. The word I wanted to borrow from something you said very quickly in passing, but a phrase that I think might be language for this in a way, moral injury, which you used briefly, refers to not just committing an atrocity yourself, but failing to prevent an atrocity. So some of what you might be describing is that feeling of, I have not done enough to spare this child this suffering, or I have somehow been a participant in the larger system, the systemic racism that causes this. And so I love your answer about keeping the focus on the person who is suffering for real, but the no less real suffering is that feeling of having been injured by some being complicit in some way. And that's the work we all, I think, have to do, all races, all generations. You know, I'm a first generation American. I could easily say, not my problem, post-slavery, racist America, but I benefit from the legacy here.
Absolutely.
So I have responsibility. Yeah. So my moral injury to address is, how can I not be part of perpetuating that?
So then you say to the kid, I'm so sorry you're going through this, you know, how can I best help you? Or I am here to be of whatever use I can be, you know? And so you show up with that expertise that you have in the role that you have. The compassion aids you in delivering whatever service and support you're supposed to be delivering.
Yeah. And I just want to jump in to say, I mean, I think Julie pretty much said it all and said it so beautifully, but like, the idea, I think we have to be cautious when we use the words compassion and empathy, because I think so often when we read something and we feel compassion, or when we hear someone's story and we feel empathy for them, a lot of times that's like for us, right? Like, it makes us feel good about ourselves that we feel compassion, that we feel moved. And I think we have to make sure that that compassion or that empathy leads us somewhere, right? And that we find ways to turn it into action.
Thank you so much. The books are going to be for sale downstairs. We have down here.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.